Welcome to another talk today. I don't know how many days have gone past, but who cares? Sometimes we always come to the last day and think, only the last day of the retreat, time is going past. But then I say, if it's just one day is 24 hours. 24 hours, 60 minutes an hour, that's, what's that, 1,440 minutes. That's almost 84,000 seconds. That's almost like 100,000 seconds. And any second you can get enlightened. That's 100,000 chances to get enlightened. And that's only one day. You have many days left. So many hundreds of thousands of chances to get enlightened. So don't worry, I'll do it the next moment. No, just remember that this is a great opportunity. And in order to get that peace and happiness, I've told many people before that in meditation we never use willpower, we use what's called wisdom power. Wisdom power is another word for sort of insight. So as your mindfulness gets stronger, as you can see deeper, you can understand more. And you know it's right understanding that you actually have got an insight because the problems disappear. That's the sign of insight, that the problems are seen, they disappear, they vanish, and as a result, you get peace. And I gave you one of those insights, you know, when I talked about the demon who came into the emperor's palace and how you overcome that demon. You get insight into overcoming problems. You never overcome problems through force or through anger. You overcome the problems. As they say in the suttas, you see Mara. Mara is this tempter, this demon. Actually, you see, Mara is like the control freak in chief. If ever you actually study Buddhism, you see in all of these heavenly realms where people can get reborn, that this guy Mara, he's in the realm called the Paramita Vasavati realm. He's in the realm of beings who control others. He is the control freak in chief. The boss control freak. That's called Mara. So he always wants to come and control you. The worst thing, the really thing which really pisses off Mara is if you let go. That's why when you are letting go and getting peaceful, something comes up inside you, say, come on, do something. Come on, control. Come on, just focus on something. Come on. Just do it a little bit. And then you get peaceful. And that is Mara getting involved and controlling you. And in the suttas, whenever Mara would come up to the Buddha or to any of the disciples or to anyone else, they would not fight Mara. They would not punch him or give him a karate kick. All they needed to do to overcome this Mara, stopping people getting enlightened, is to say, I know you, Mara. In other words, to see Mara clearly with insight, I know you, Mara. And then Mara would say, she knows me. And would hunch his shoulders and go away despondent. It was wisdom power which defeats Mara. It's wisdom power which defeats, you know, your problems, not willpower. And because of that, sometimes around this time in the retreat, some of you may be meditating many days and be getting nowhere. Absolutely waste of time. You're wondering, what should I do next? I've tried everything and nothing works and I can't meditate for my life. What am I going to tell my friends when I go back to Singapore that I've wasted my time? They're going to say, did you get enlightened? I said, no. Did you get any meditation success? No. What happened? I just got bored. And you feel very embarrassed. So you try really hard to get something back to tell your friends, your relations and people you work with just to justify the fact you spent 7 days or 8, 9 days of your life coming here. But if ever you get into the murky depths of meditative despair, you've tried everything and nothing works, and your mind gets more and more crazy, more and more difficult, and you think you're going out of your head, Now is the time to use what I call the Nalagiri strategy. This is for people, they've heard about the five hindrances. This is when they get all the five hindrances at the same time. That's what someone once told me. They said that the last day, they got all the five hindrances attacking them all at once. And I thought, how can that be? How can you have sloth and torpor and restlessness at the same time? How can you have wanting and not wanting? I said, yeah, I did. And all the hindrances came to them and I'm driving them crazy. And so when that happens, I always remember the story which many of you might have known if you've learned some of the history of Buddhism, of Nalagiri. Because once some people wanted to kill the Buddha, they wanted to assassinate him, murder him. And they didn't have US drones at that time, so they had to use other measures. And what they did was they had this elephant and they gave him alcohol, lots of it, until the elephant was totally out of his mind, drunk. And early in the morning, when they knew the Buddha was coming on arms round through the narrow streets of Rajagaha, they let the elephant loose in the opposite direction. So there, the mad elephant, drunk with alcohol, was charging down the road while the Buddha was walking peacefully in the opposite direction. It was like that movie I saw as a kid, High Noon. Who would win? As a peaceful Buddha and a violent elephant were soon going to meet in the streets of Rajagaha. And the people were running away. And they saw the Buddha come and say, get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming down the street. And all the monks who were following the Buddha, all those peaceful, wise monks who were willing to give their life, not today, they jumped over the fences, climbed the trees, ran through the doors, they scarpered. All except Ananda, the faithful disciple of the Buddha, who realizing the elephant was coming in his direction, stood in front of his teacher, put his hands out and said, let the elephant kill me. I will protect my master. Wasn't that sweet? Would you do that to me? Or would you climb up the trees? I know what you do. But the Buddha just gently pushed Ananda aside. It's very nice, very sort of nice gesture, but get out of the way, I can handle this. So when all the other people had gone, there was just the raging, mad, powerful elephant and the Buddha, peaceful and kind. Who would win? Now, I have no doubts at all that the Buddha had great psychic powers. He was massively powerful in what they call the iddhis, these meditative developed psychic powers. I often thought that we don't talk enough about psychic powers. Maybe you can't say them personally, but some monks do have those. So much so that recently in Singapore at a film festival, I suggested at the film festival it's about time the Buddhist culture became more mainstream and we started a movie franchise called Super Monk with his psychic powers but great wisdom. So Super Monk, like Superman or Batman or Iron Man or Green Lantern or all these other superheroes you're making movies about, he would be non-violent. He'd be able to levitate in the air and catch the plane before it hit the Twin Towers. But then he wouldn't take the terrorists to jail, to Guantanamo Bay. He would just teach them the Dhamma, give them the five precepts, and they would become monks and live happily ever after. And it's the ideas are huge. I could write many scripts on the adventures of Super Monk. And because this is the 21st century, of course, once we have the three episodes of Super Monk, we'll also have to have Super Bhikkhuni. And Super Nun would also be flying through the air and saving the world. And then you'd have to have Super Novice as well, the little fellow. And maybe Super Gay Buddhist or what, I don't know. But anyway, there's lots of franchises there, because psychic powers, you know, through meditation, but the wisdom as well, which is really important. But how to get into that? What was I talking about? Oh, the elephant, yes. So back to the elephant. So there was the elephant charging down the street against the great super-powered Buddha. Then what did the Buddha do? I often thought about that. You know, the Buddha could have just caught the trunk of the elephant. And just, that's right, yeah, da-da-da-da-da. You got it. Wound it round its head three times and then chucked it over the Ganges River about 300 miles away. That'd be easy for a Buddha. They can do that. But the Buddha wasn't violent. He didn't use force. Instead, according to the story, he used metta. He would have done something like seeing that charging elephant towards him, red-eyed, mad, crazy, snorting, this huge elephant charging towards him. He'd have just stood there and said, "Dear elephant, kind elephant, the door of my heart is fully open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. You can squash me under your feet, making little hamburger patties. You can take me by your trunk and throw me over the Ganges or smash me against the wall. You can kill me and hurt me, but the door of my heart will always be open to you. I'd always love you, dear elephant." And with that type of loving kindness, that's the superpower of a Buddha. And according to the story, after a few seconds, the elephant had stopped in front of the Buddha, calmed down with his trunk down, and the Buddha was stroking his trunk. "There, Nalagiri. It's all right, Nalagiri. Just relax. Watch your breath." He never said that. And that's how the Buddha, you can't say defeated, but use the great wisdom and kindness power to overcome the problem. And that's how you overcome problems in life, especially crazy problems in meditation. Mind's going all over the place, what should I do? Because sometimes your mind is like a crazy elephant, just rushing around, bashing everything, destroying everything. That's your mind sometimes. So what do? You try and stop it. Come on, use your force. That never works. Instead, you should use the Nalagiri strategy. "Mind, dear mind, you may drive me crazy and send me permanently to the Institute of Mental Health in the north of Singapore. You may make me crazy forever. You may destroy my sanity and make me mad. But never mind, you may destroy me, mind, for the door of my heart will always be open to you, crazy mind of mine. You may think, go to sleep, think of all sorts of crazy things which you'd be so embarrassed if Ajahn Brahm read your mind and told everybody else about. But I still love you, mind. You can do whatever you want. The door of my heart's open to you, mind." And what happens next if you have that beautiful kindness towards your mind? Within a couple of seconds, your mind has stopped, bowing its head, and you just stroke it. "There, mind. It's all right. Ajahn Brahm loves you. It's all right." And then your mind stops. It's called like the power of metta, of loving kindness, allowing things to be, being kind and respecting your mind. If you do things like that, it's amazing just how soon you have beautiful peace. And that gives rise to the insight, the power of wisdom and kindness rather than brute force. Unfortunately, many people even now use brute force. They want to sit through the pain. They want to push through their defilements. They want to try even harder. But it doesn't work. There's a story, a simile, which I haven't given yet. And I need, Daniel, would you please come up here because I need your assistance. Just like in the TV when I was young, you used to get like the magician doing a trick and you'd have his beautiful assistant who would come along. Unfortunately, we don't have beautiful assistants, but we really got that. Don't tell that to Mike, I'll get in trouble. So, this is how not to meditate. And then I'll tell you how to meditate. It's a simile of holding a cup of water. Now, I told you already that meditation, samadhi, the first day, means stillness. That's what meditation is. You're so still and peaceful, nothing's moving. So I'll now meditate with this cup of water, holding it totally still. Now, Dania, my assistant, is it still yet?
It's moving.
It's moving. So what should I do? Try harder. My assistant, is it stopped yet?
It's moving more, actually.
So I'll really concentrate this time. I've been meditating all week. Still haven't got my mind still. I'm going to concentrate really this time. Any luck yet?
No.
You know, I just can't meditate. I'm hopeless. I've been here in this joint for 5 or 6 days. A great teacher, great food, great place, and I still can't get my mind still. I'm hopeless. That's what some of you may feel. You're not hopeless. You're just stupid. You're not following the instructions. You try and hold your mind still through force, through willpower, you will never do it. And of course, what's the way, what I've been telling you to do all week? Put it down. Oops. That's what people do. Put it down. As soon as I put it down, does it move more?
Yeah.
That's interesting. When you let things go, they actually move more than usual. But just be patient. Now, how's that? Yeah, is that? You can come and see for yourself if you like. Okay, thank you, assistant. A big round of applause for my beautiful assistant. I should have been on the TV. It's actually perfectly still now. Now that's called letting go, using wisdom power, through insight. You realize what you're supposed to let go of. And you let it go, you put it down, you leave it alone. It's a wonderful experience. So you leave the mind alone and you find, wow, it's still all by itself. Amazing. Not only the first night, but some of you will come later on. Remember when I told you that story of my years, I think 5th or 6th year as a monk, perfect monastery to stay in, when I had all my unmonkish thoughts? Remember that story? Those unmonkish thoughts, you know, I tried to stop them, but I couldn't stop them at all. And as soon as I said, okay, 3 to 4 o'clock every afternoon, I won't try and stop anything. If I wanted to think about romance, girlfriends, whatever, I could think whatever I liked. As soon as I just left my mind alone, it got very peaceful. Most peaceful hour of the day, when I stopped fighting. It was strange for me to experience that at the time. I didn't understand why. But now I understand the simile of the cup. When you try and hold the cup and try and make it still, it never becomes still. You put it down, leave it alone, and then it becomes still. It's called letting go. And sometimes in your meditation, you will, as I say, press that letting go button. You leave it alone. You just watch. And if you can do that, you'll find your mind gets very, very peaceful. Every time your mind does get peaceful like that, please reflect, what did I do? What happened that my mind got all peaceful? And you'll find it's some form of letting go that you've done. You've done something there which has put the problem down and it's become still all by itself. And that is the insight into meditation. How to have stillness and how to have peace is not by forcing it, not by making it happen, by sitting down and letting it happen. The difference, don't make it happen, let it happen. You get out of the way and everything gets very peaceful and calm and still. And the whole journey of meditation is just learning that much. How to press the letting go button. Unfortunately, that many people keep asking me, yes, I understand, I've got to put the cup down. But how do I do that? Please tell me how to let go. Number one, see how stupid the question it is? You don't do letting go. You stop doing anything. You let go of doing. You don't do letting go. When you let go of doing things, when you get that insight, because you've had an experience, it's peaceful, you've let go of something, then you understand through the experience of putting things down. Oh, that's what it is. All these years, and the Buddha, and the monks, the nuns, Ajahn Brahm's been teaching me this. Oh, that's what it means, at last. That's why it takes a long time to get you to let things go. And the reason why is because, you know, your mind is just so restless, you don't know how to be still. You've got what we call in Buddhism, the monkey mind. Have you heard about the monkey mind before? If you haven't, here's a story about the monkey mind. Once, this happened in Sri Lanka. It was a full moon day, like yesterday. And if ever you go to especially the forest monasteries in Sri Lanka on the full moon day, you'll always find many monkeys visit the temple. Because there's so much food there that someone's going to drop something, a banana or a mango or something there. And of course the monkeys are really quick. They'll grab that banana or that mango and eat it. There was one temple I visited in Sri Lanka some years ago. And the monkeys, they're really, really smart. What they would do, they would wait in the early morning and they'd see the monks go out on arms round. They wouldn't attack the monks because they knew their bowls were empty. But what they would do, they'd hide in the trees, waiting for them to return. And as the monk was mindfully walking back, the monkey would jump on his back. Ah! And the bowl of food would go all over the floor. And that was monkey's lunch. And the poor monk had to go hungry. So that's what the monkeys used to do. So when I did that, they always said, look, watch your back. The monkeys are watching you somewhere. And if your lack of mindfulness, they'll jump on your back and your bowl will go all over the place and you lose your lunch. But this particular monkey, he went to the temple to try and find something to eat. And because it was like, you know, this big full moon day, the monk was actually giving a sermon in the hall. And the monkey, just out of interest, wanted to listen to see what the monk was saying. And when he heard this Buddhist priest start talking about the monkey mind, the monkey got really interested. You know, because all like, you know, famous people talking about us. So he started to listen. You know, I didn't realize these monks knew about us. But when he heard what the monk was saying about the monkey mind being a bad mind, a restless mind, a terrible mind, the sort of mind you try to get rid of, the last type of mind you want to want, you don't want to be like a monkey. Now that monkey, he was quite offended. What's wrong with a monkey mind? That's discrimination. That's defamation. That's illegal. You can't get away with that in the modern world. And that monkey was just so upset. And immediately he swam back into the forest. He didn't have anything to eat. And he complained to the leader of his tribe. You should hear what these Buddhist so-called wise people are saying about us. They're defaming us. They're offending us. It's not right. Monkey minds are okay. They're monkeys. What do you expect? They should respect us instead of using us as a simile for bad meditators. And all the other monkeys were also upset. They're jumping up and down. We can't allow this. We've got to do something about this. We can't stand for this. We've got to protest. We've got to do something. This is wrong. This is not right. And the leader of the monkeys saw them all jumping up and down and said, "That is the monkey mind. That's what those monks were talking about. They're right, look at us." And all the monkeys realized, oh God, they're right. We have got monkey minds. Because we're monkeys. So what can we do about that? And the head monkey, because the head monkey had been around a while, is quite wise. And he said, "Look, I've seen in these monasteries, when I visited to get some food, the way these monks and nuns and lay men, lay women, the way they overcome their monkey mind is by meditating. Why don't we meditate too?" So all the monkeys jumped up and down, "Yeah, let's meditate. Yeah, we'll meditate. No more monkey minds for the monkeys. How do we do it?" And so the head monk, he didn't know too much, but he knows, so meditate, you sit down cross-legged, and it's right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, back straight, heads down, and watch your breath. So all the monkeys, first of all, they got some grass, made themselves nice zafus. You know, some people, like, at the back of them, made this huge, huge cushion out of grass. And they all sat there. Now, right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, back straight, head down, watching their breath, breathing in, breathing out. That was the first time monkeys ever meditated in the jungle. But not for long. After 30 seconds, one of the monkeys put the hand up. "Excuse me, excuse me." So all the monkeys opened their eyes. "What is it?" He said, "I've just been thinking. You know, we were planning today to go and raid the banana orchard, the banana plantation, to get our lunch. I know it's not lunchtime yet, you know, lunchtime is not till 11 o'clock, but you keep thinking about it. So, can't we get it out of the way first of all? They won't eat it, we'll just, you know, pinch the bananas, and then we get it out of the way, and I don't start thinking about it, and I can meditate then." And all the monkeys said, "Great idea, great idea." So they all got off their seats, swung to the banana plantation, stole hundreds of bananas for the whole troop of monkeys, brought them back to where they were meditating, put them in a big pile in the center there. They weren't going to eat yet, it's not lunchtime, they're just getting it out of the way. So they didn't have to think about it. And then they all sat down. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, back straight, heads down, watching the breath. "Excuse me," said another monkey after 30 seconds. He said, "I've been thinking. You know what you do in meditation, you guys, you think. And I've been thinking, you know, before we eat those mangoes, we have to peel them. So can we get that out of the way, first of all? And then I'll meditate." And all of them said, "Yeah, good idea, I've been thinking the same." So they all peeled the bananas. They didn't eat them yet. It wasn't lunchtime. They just, you know, get it out of the way so they don't have to think about it. So they peeled all the bananas in a nice big heap. They sat down on the meditation cushions, right paw over the left paw, right leg over the left leg, back straight, heads down, watching their breath. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. "Excuse me," said another monkey. "I've been thinking. You know, before we eat those mangoes, we've got to put them in our mouth. Let's get that out of the way, first of all." "And then we'll meditate. We won't eat it yet, we'll just put it in our mouth." "Great idea," said the other monkeys. So they all jumped up, they all got a banana each. Now there's one or two, put two, one actually put three bananas in their mouth. There's always one here. You just look at the dining area. You see this. There's always one who takes so much. But anyway, they all put a banana in their mouth, some two, one, three. Close their eyes, left, right paw over the left paw, right leg over the left leg, sort of back straight, head down, and of course, once their eyes were closed, they ate all those bananas. And that's the definition, the explanation of a monkey mind. Let's get it out of the way first of all, then I'll meditate. And that's called the monkey mind. How many of you? Ah, let's get my bags packed, let's get my teeth brushed, let's get the dishes washed, let's get this finished, then I'll meditate. If you do that in your next lifetime, you'll be born as a monkey. Monkey mind. So no, don't get things out of the way. That's too much thinking. Leave them alone. If you like, get meditation out of the way, first of all. Become enlightened and then go and take the bananas. So it's giving these things priority. What's more important to you? A lot of that is about the insights which we get. You know that sometimes people complain to me that, oh, they're just sitting there peacefully and a thought comes from nowhere. I used to think like that, the thoughts come from, they don't come from nowhere. You go out looking for them. Maybe you're not mindful and aware enough to see that process. When I got more mindful in my meditation, I realized, no, they didn't come from nowhere. I was getting a little bit bored and I went to seek for a thought just to distract myself. Just like people go onto the TV and they surf all the channels looking for something to be interested in. And there's nothing on the TV, even though there's 60 channels. They go into the refrigerator to see if there's something to eat. Even though it's chock-a-block with something, there's nothing to eat. That's a sort of mind which is unsatisfied, discontent, which goes looking for something to distract yourself, looking for a thought to come in. And so when I saw that, I thought, no, the thoughts don't come in, I go looking for them. And why do I go looking for them? Again, it's because of discontent, you're not happy to be here. Which actually brings me to what I'm supposed to be talking about this morning. I've gone off a bit with a few stories. Is how to let go. You know the monkey mind. Number one, get peace out of the way first of all, instead of you do something else. That's more important. Give priority. You know, to stillness, peace, and all those other problems in the world, all those other things you think, you know, you want to think about, all the things you want to solve back home. Some of you come here, and you've got all these problems which you're going to face when you get back, and you think, oh, should I start thinking about these, working it all out? No. You will find, as I've found many times, if you leave your monastery and there's so many problems, and you think, my goodness, if I don't solve them, it's going to get worse. Actually, when you get out of the way, the problems usually get better. They usually solve themselves, many of the problems of life. Just like when I went to give that talk on Tuesday at university on human rights, I was poking through some old articles, and I found the article about, which I have in my room, in my desk, about the hospitals in Jerusalem. All the doctors went on strike for a couple of weeks. No doctors worked. And during those 2 weeks, the death rate in Jerusalem plummeted. People were much healthier and the doctors weren't looking after them. It was done, the research is there. So you wondered, gee, what's these doctors doing? And there's all these tests and tests and tests. There's only doctors here, I'm sorry, but I'll show you the piece of paper later on. So, you know, sometimes when you leave things alone, they get better. You start to interfere and fix it all up, it gets worse, just like your mind. So you just leave it alone. It will sort itself out. And all the problems in the future, they usually fix themselves. You know, you're worried about what your husband's going to do when you're here. Well, you know, if he runs away with your best friend, fine, you got rid of him. Way! And if, you know, you find out that in the last 9 days the stock market has crashed, you know, and there's another recession or depression, oh, great! I've got no money left, there's no other choice, I have to become a monk. It doesn't matter what happens. But look, you usually find that when you don't worry about things, they get better. When you worry about them, they get worse. Have you ever noticed that? So you leave them alone. So you can let go of the worries of the future. If it's going to happen, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. You keep this incredibly positive mind about the future. Now, I already mentioned that story, you know, good, bad, who knows. Now, a lot of people these days, you know, are really afraid, especially of doing things like flying. And some of the disciples asked me once here in Perth, they said, but I go flying a lot. You know, early Monday morning I'm flying off to London to see my mum and then all these other flights which I have to take before the end of the year, going here, going there, teaching the Dhamma. And they say, aren't you afraid, Ajahn Brahm? Can you please have these stockings which stop you getting, deep vein thrombosis? Can you please take a mask so you don't catch some terrible disease? Can you please not eat the food? It might be poisoned. Can you please? You know, oh, come on. You know, I'm going to die sometime. And look, you know, one of the worst things that people are afraid of is like terrorists. You know, are you afraid, Ajahn Brahm, that there might be a, what was that guy, the underpants bomber on your flight to London? Are you afraid of dying in an aircraft explosion at 30,000 feet? And I told them, I worked out when I was asked that question the first time, no, I'm not afraid of dying in aircraft explosion up in the air. You know, if there's an explosion there, you've got no chance. If you survive the explosion, you won't survive the fall. You're dead. Are you afraid? Nothing between you and a long drop. So no, I'm not afraid. And I told them, and I tell you now because many of you will be flying back to Singapore soon. I told them the three advantages, the three benefits of dying at 30,000 feet. And when you understand this, you're not afraid at all. In fact, you know, you quite hope it might happen. And the first advantage of dying at 30,000 feet in aircraft explosion is called the instant cremation. Now, recently I went to a cremation over in Singapore, you know, in the state crematorium, the government crematorium up in the north by Woodland somewhere, you know, by the reservoir. And it's so complicated. You have to wait there for the casket to come and do all these ceremonies, and then you take it to the viewing room, put it in the ovens, and you have to take so much time off work, it costs a lot of money. In aircraft, it's done for you. Instantly, no worries. So that's the first advantage. You know, instant, free cremation. So it doesn't trouble the family. Actually, the second benefit, it doesn't just not trouble the family. Those cremations, they do cost a lot of money. Over here in Perth, usually, you know, even a cheap one, $7,000-$8,000. That's a cheap one. Imagine you do these big ones over in Singapore, you have to feed all of these hangers on who say they're your family for, you know, days on end, and gee, it costs a lot of money. And that's to be really nice food too. And give, even worse, you get the monks or the nuns to come and do chanting. You know how much they charge for doing chanting? You know, it's actually cheaper. It's cheaper to give me a plane ticket over to Singapore to do the charging and send me back again to get a local, because I don't charge. It is, you know. But please don't do that. I'm just doing that. I should have said that. I knew as soon as I said that, I should not have said that. But if you die at 30,000 feet in the air, it's not only instant cremation, but for once, your family makes money out of your cremation. You get insurance payout. You get quite a lot if you die in an aircraft explosion, you get quite a lot of money. So your family are rich that you've died. So that's the second benefit, out of compassion. You don't just cost nothing for your family, you actually give some money to your family. So if I died at 30,000 feet, you know, down here, remember, the insurance goes to the nuns' monastery, I can make some merit. And the best of all, the third and best benefit of dying at 30,000 feet is, if you die at that altitude, you're so close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. So those are the three benefits of dying at 30,000 feet. So if you see any terrorists in the plane, don't worry. Whee! My three benefits are coming up. Actually, that reminds me of another joke. I'll get on to how to let go in a few minutes. This again, yeah? Set it up here, because please, right. Shall we? I'll hold it up here. And the best benefit of all. No. This was, I don't know if you heard this story, but there was this guy who was travelling on the aircraft. SQ, Singapore Airlines. And he was, you know, he was on the window seat. And this guy came on with a dog. The guy sat next to him, and the dog was in the aisle seat. And he said, you can't have a dog on an aircraft. And he said, this is SQ, Singapore Airlines, special security dog. And the handler said, look, I'll show you how it works. So he sent the dog down the aisle, and there was one of these young backpackers, you know, from Europe going on holiday. And the dog smelt him, smelt his bag, and he wagged his tail and barked once. And the handler said, wow, look at that. That's the sign. That guy is carrying marijuana. When he gets to the other end, we'll tell the police to have him arrested. You know, just, you know, marijuana for personal use. Let's see what else is on here. So he sent him up to business class. And in the business class, the dog smelt this, you know, young businesswoman. He wagged his tail and barked twice. My goodness, said the handler, that's a sign of cocaine. That woman is carrying cocaine. We'll tell the police and have her arrested too. Let's see what else is on this flight. So then they went up to first class. There they saw this immaculately dressed businessman. And the dog smelt his briefcase, wagged his tail and barked three times. My goodness, said the handler, that's heroin. Amazing having all these drugs on the same plane. We'll arrest him. Let's just see what else is on this plane. And then the dog went to the back of the plane, and there he smelt a man with a turban. He didn't wag his tail, he put his tail between his legs, jumped up on the chair, and pooed all over the chair. And the handler said, oh my goodness. He said, what does that mean? Said the traveller. That's a sign of a bomb. The dog pooed all over the chair. He knew he was going to die. Okay. But it worked the last time. Anyway. So that's what you do when you're really afraid. You know, you let go. Okay, now back to real letting go. Oh my goodness, only got 10 minutes left. There is what we call the four ways of letting go. I mentioned one the other day. The first way of letting go is generosity. Giving. Expecting nothing back in return. That's why in most monasteries we don't have donation boxes. Dania, who have you got donation box on that donation box? Because we should actually change it, cause to be consistent with what I've always told people in Singapore, it's not a donation box. It is a letting go box. So you put letting go box on. Now if it's real generosity, as I said yesterday, you give yourself to this moment. You give yourself to today. You give all your mindfulness to the meditation object. Expecting nothing back in return. It's because you expect something back. I'll meditate if I get jhana. I'll come on this retreat as long as I get peaceful. I'll listen to the talk as long as Ajahn Brahm tells a joke or something. If you expect something, especially you expect a good joke, you get a lot of suffering. So you give expecting nothing back in return. Real giving is living life not expecting anything back. That is called letting go. You know, you serve, say, the Buddhist fellowship. You don't expect praise. You don't expect anything. You just give because it's a beautiful thing to do. I come here and spend 99 days with you. Now I really give as much as I can. I don't expect anything back. You give with no expectations. That's letting go. So please meditate, giving all of your energy, all of your mind, all of your mindfulness to this moment. But don't expect to be peaceful. Don't expect to have nimittas or jhanas. Because if you have the slightest expectation, it's not giving. It's not letting go. The second type of meditation is called chucking things away. Ajahn Chah used to say, we meditate not to attain things, not to get more things, but to see how many things we can get rid of. We meditate to let go of things, not to attain more things. So your meditation is not to attain insights, nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment experiences. That's just more things. We try to let go of things, become more peaceful, more empty. The less you have, the more peaceful you feel. So we meditate to have less, not more. To see, like this room over here, You see this room? We don't have any pictures on the wall. We've got a very simple shrine. We have got no flowers in the corner. It's a very simple room. And it's a great battle to keep it simple, because people say, oh, can we put some flowers in the corner? Say, no, oh, they look nice. No, can we put a picture on the wall? Can we put a picture of, you know, the places where the Buddha lived? Some nice murals. Can we decorate it? Can we have some chandeliers? No. We keep it simple. Because, you know, when it's really simple like this, it's really easy to clean. And it's easy to get around. The less things you have, the easier it is to look after. When you go home, look in your lounge room. There's so much stuff in there. You know, it's like a junkyard. It's just like a jungle, a forest of so much stuff. And you can hardly get around things. Anyone who's a bit overweight like me will probably never be able to squeeze around the furniture. So, see if you can live simply. Have less things, not more. And then you have more happiness, more freedom. So that's called throwing things away. The next part of letting go is my favorite. It really is contentment. Contentment is called letting go. And to understand that story, this was happened again when one of our monks went into prison. It's a famous meditation story. Another golden oldie for those of you who have heard it before. One of our monks was in the prison teaching meditation. He'd been going there for several weeks. And one of the prisoners said, can you please stay behind a little longer? Because we want to talk with you. You're a friend. Not just about meditation, but know who you are. So he stayed behind. And they gave him some tea and some chocolate and cheese. It's amazing what a monk would do for some tea, chocolate and cheese. So he stayed behind, and they started talking to him about all sorts of things. And especially they were really interested. What's it like being a monk? What do you do in your monastery? And that's where he told them the usual routine of Bodhinyana Monastery over the road. So he started in the morning. What time do you get up in the morning? And the answer is, over in Bodhinyana Monastery, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And when the prisoners heard that, 4 o'clock in the morning! Even murderers don't have to get up that time in the morning. What have you done wrong that you have to get up so early? And that's when the monk also said what I said earlier. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning in our monastery over the road is optional. It's a choice. Because you can always get up earlier if you want to. And then what do? After you've got up, can you watch the late night movie on the TV? No, we don't have TVs over in monastery. You know they have TVs in most of the prisons here. You know, it keeps the prisoners quiet. They can watch the movies and the prison officers don't have any trouble with them. But not in Bodhinyana Monastery. You say, oh, that's really terrible. No TVs there. So what do you do for breakfast? And we usually have a simple breakfast over in Bodhinyana Monastery. Usually just like a cup with cereals and milk, that's it. Simple breakfast. Over here I get spoiled. That's why I like having breakfast over here for the retreat. But, then what do you do after breakfast? All the monks this morning, because it's the end of the range retreat, will be working. Tidying up the place for the Katina ceremony on Sunday. Working. And sometimes we work very, very hard. If you don't believe that, you show some of the pictures of when I was working on the roof of the cottage over there. And I put on that roof. I was up there on the ladders and drilling and putting things in. Ajahn Brahm, you're a teacher. You shouldn't do that. No. All monks have to work hard. And when the prisoners heard how hard we have to work, they said, oh, they never make us work that hard. So what do you have for lunch? And we do have lunch, we have quite a big lunch, but if you go over to Bodhinyana, we see we eat it all out of one bowl. Everything goes into one bowl in that monastery. Very often, not once, many times, I've had custard on top of my curry. Yeah, you try to put the, you know, the sort of the sweets to one side, but sometimes it spills and it goes, you have curry and custard. Sometimes it was actually quite recently, it was strawberry ice cream on top of spaghetti. It was. Have you ever had strawberry ice cream over spaghetti? How do you know? You all think it's disgusting, don't you? Actually, you're right, it is disgusting. Terrible. But you eat that, and they said, look, even when you're in solitary confinement, they give you like a tray, and the ice cream's on one side, spaghetti's on another. That's disgusting. You live like that. So what do you do after lunch? You know, can you play sport, have a game of soccer? And I told people that, you know, sometimes I really did think of starting a Buddhist soccer team in our Buddhist society in Nolomara. You know, just because, you know, it's a way of getting community spirit, and maybe, you know, we can play with some of the other religious schools and maybe have Theravada versus Mahayana or whatever. And maybe the Christians versus the Buddhists. But I soon thought, no, it wouldn't work having a Buddhist soccer team. Because if it was a real Buddhist soccer team, we'd have to play by Buddhist principles. And Buddhist principles means if the other team wanted the ball, let it go. Compassion. Yeah, take it, take it. You know, we're not attached. And if the other team couldn't score a goal, you know, we score one for them. Oh, it's a Buddhist soccer team. That's why you never find any Buddhists playing for Manchester United. They keep giving the ball away out of kindness. Anyway, so now we don't play any sport, we meditate. And they said, oh, okay, you know, monks are meditating, let's expect that. So when do you have dinner? I said, dinner? Monks don't have dinner, that's it, lunch is finished. Wow, that's disgusting, they only feed you that twice a day. Everybody has a dinner and evening, that's the best meal of the day. You monks have nothing yet, a cup of tea maybe. So what do you do after dinner? You know, can you play cards? Can you play Monopoly or video games? Said, no, we have nothing of that. And they said, don't tell us. You meditate, don't you? Yeah. God. Don't you get tired of meditating? And the monk was quite honest and said, well, yeah, sometimes. So what time do you go to bed? He said, bed? We don't have beds. You've been in my cave. That's where I sleep. Sleep on the floor. They don't give you beds in your monastery. That's terrible. And after he said what monks, how monks live in Australia, just over the road, that one of the prisoners was so upset because he liked this monk. And for a moment he forgot where he was. And he said to that monk, that's so hard and terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? And he said that before he realized what he said. It was such a funny statement. It's true, you know. It's more ascetic, harsh, over in Bodhinyana Monastery than it is in a prison in Australia. The prisoners have a much softer, more comfortable life than the monks over in the monastery over the road, and the nuns too. So why is it? We had a meeting yesterday afternoon with all the monks, thinking, what the heck are we going to do? Because too many people want to come. It's like a waiting list. You know, it's, should we build more huts? Or should we somehow limit the people who want to come and stay? What should we do? Because there's a waiting list of people trying to get into my monastery. There's a waiting list of people trying to get out of prison. So what is the difference there? And the difference is this. It's the difference between freedom and being in prison. A prison is any place you don't want to be. It can be very comfortable with TVs, good food, nice beds. But if you don't want to be there, it's a prison. Freedom, doesn't matter if it's harsh and austere, if you want to be there, it's called freedom. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. Any place you're content is called freedom. Now you understand why many of you have been in prison in this retreat center many moments during the last few days. You're meditating, you don't want to be here. You want to be somewhere else. That's called prison. Even though it might be comfortable, even though you may get good food, nice jokes, still, if you don't want to be here, it's called prison. Sometimes you'll be meditating. Maybe you'll be getting peaceful, but you want the nimitta. Maybe you got nimitta, but you want jhanas. You just made another prison for yourself, the nimitta prison. I want to be somewhere else. That's why it's not called letting go. Some of you are in jobs you hate, and your office is your prison. You can't wait to escape in the evening. Some of you may be in relationships which are really uncomfortable, you don't want to be there, and you find your marriage is like a prison. Some of you are in very sick bodies. You're afraid it's going to get even more sick. Your body becomes a prison because you don't want to be there. All you need to do to escape from these prisons of life, you don't need to change your husband. Take it from me, I know these things. If you change your husband, you'll get more of the same. Men are all the same. Of course they are. Okay, now the exterior may have a new paint job, but inside the engine's all the same. Same with girls too. So to escape, don't try and change things. Change your job, change your partner, even change your body. Instead, change your attitude. Want to be here. Your husband, he may not be the best, but he's good enough. Look, be honest, he's as good as you're going to get. And this body, come on, be honest, it's this old. You're doing pretty well, there's only a few aches and pains. So well done. So when you're happy to be here, with a sick old body, you know, with a grumpy old husband, with a nagging old wife, you know, in a cold old jhana grove, as long as you're happy to be here, then you are free. So that's the most important part of letting go. Just want to be here. When you want to be here, you feel so free. No matter what that is. Restless mind? I want to be with my restless mind. Then you're free. You're sleepy? I want to be sleepy. Then you're free. So please, every moment of this retreat, want to be here. Be content. Then you find this incredible freedom. You're letting go. And all these amazing things happen to you. Last of all, the last way of letting go is called having the Teflon mind. You know this Teflon? You know, nothing sticks to it. In the old days, we used to call it like the lotus leaf mind. The beautiful scented Chanel No. 5 can drop on to the lotus leaf and it just flows off and there's no scent left, no odor. Urine falls onto the lotus leaf and that too falls away without any smell. Nothing sticks to the lotus leaf. Just like Teflon. So you have a mind just like that. You stupid idiot. And it just runs off you. And nothing stays. You're the best meditator I've ever had the privilege to teach in all my years. No, in all my lifetimes as a monk. And nothing sticks. It just flows off. So you keep absolutely nothing. It's why you have two ears. One to go in. One to go out. You keep nothing. So your mind is free and empty and still. So that's called the Teflon mind. Letting go because nothing sticks at all. Soon as it arises, it passes away, leaving no residue. Letting go. So those are the four ways of letting go. No expectations. See how many things you're meditating to let go, not to attain. Just being happy to be here and feeling this beautiful freedom, just happy to be where you are. And lastly, nothing sticks. The four ways of letting go. If you do that, you find it works, you get very peaceful, you get the insight, understanding, that's what meditation is. And then you have a happy time. I'm not going to stick around because I'm going to leave now. So there's a few interviews, quick interviews, because at 9:30 I've got to go out for an appointment. So happy meditating. I'll be back this afternoon. Oh, yeah, the interviews this afternoon, I have to delay them until 4 o'clock. So instead of 3:10, 3:20, 3:30, it'll be 4 o'clock, 4:10, 4:20, okay? Still interviews, but, you know, from 4 o'clock till 5. Same people,
different times, so please remember, 4 o'clock, 10 past 4, etc., not 3 o'clock. And I'll see you this afternoon. And hopefully when I come back, you're all so enlightened, so content. You scratch all the names off. No, I don't need to come anymore, Ajahn Brahm. I'm totally enlightened, totally free. Thank you so much. Okay, have a great day.